Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop. Fun. Recorded live in California, USA, it's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. The show that loves big, likes pop, has fun. Now from the Wilson World Studios, here's Tom.
Thank you, Jeff. Jeff Harlan, the man, the myth, the Jeff. Welcome, everybody, to the Big Pop Fun Podcast. I'm Tom Wilson. This podcast is brought to you by BigPopFun.com. Hey, folks, support the arts. Buy art. And by Boopsy.com. It's a world-class multi-platform mobile solution that is fast, flexible, and disruptively affordable. Find out more about Boopsy at Boopsy.com. BOOPSIE.com. When I met my friend Mark McClure in 1985, he was a very successful actor who combined both things that to me made you a working actor. And that was the term of highest respect to me that acting students used. For not a movie star, that seemed kind of dreamy and probably out of reach for me, certainly, but for most of us. But in acting school, we use the term working actor for a respected professional. He was a working actor, not only acting in great hip movies like I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars, but he also worked in TV. He worked in commercials. Bottom line, Mark McClure worked because he was good. And he was nice and fun and funny, and I marveled at the ease with which Mark approached show business. I met him on that first Back to the Future, and both Mark and I, our mutual friend, Wendy Jo Sperber, who's passed away, God bless her, but Mark and Wendy both kind of took me into their circle of that cast, and we had a ball, joking and laughing, and them supporting me, and me being just amazed that fun, funny, talented people could actually come into show business and begin working, get jobs. And, of course, scratch the surface of the relaxed clown. It's a cliche, but there's usually quite a story under there. And I hope you enjoy my conversation with my old buddy. He was Jimmy Olsen from all the Superman movies. He was Dave McFly in the Back to the Future movies. He was in Apollo 13 and all just a very, very long list of credits. Here's my conversation with my buddy Mark McClure.
Big Pop Fun.
So you were
Hello, Tom Wilson.
Hey, Mark, how's it going?
Everything's good, brother.
Mark McClure. You weren't a kid actor, were you? I mean, you were really young. You looked young when you were starting in that stuff,
yeah.
But you weren't a kid actor.
When I graduated from high school, I was 4'11" and 95 pounds.
You're not serious.
Oh, I am. And I've kind of seen people. I mean, I've seen kids at elementary school that were 4'11" and 95 pounds. And when I was that small, it's like it didn't register to me that I was small. I was a great athlete. I was the most valuable athlete in the eighth grade. But I was a little guy. And
in high school, you were 4'11".
Graduated. I was 18 years old. I was 4'11" and 95 pounds. I was thinking I'd maybe be a jockey. I was sent away to military school my whole life, and maybe that had something to do with my growth spurt, because I think I'm 5'10 right now, or 5'11".
Yeah, you're about.
And that all happened from 18 to 21, 22.
So your theory is what, the freedom you got out of military school and bang, your body was just saving it up?
Don't know what the catch was. It just started going. I just started going, but it was just like I was a little guy. And what happened was I went to my first military school, Mount Low, which was really just a prison camp. It had barbed wire fence around it.
Seriously?
It was like Stalag 17. It was really a bad place.
And why did mom send you?
My parents got divorced. My brother was a little high strung, I guess. I didn't notice when I was a kid. Yeah, I was 8. He was 9. And I just kind of was in the package deal. You know, it was like an agency.
So your brother was a
brother. My brother needed it.
And you were an 8-year-old and you got the...
And I got in with him. And I'll tell you, at military school, having an older brother was very cool. I mean, it helped. And if I went there by myself, it would have been a different thing. You know, who even knows? The whole road would have been different. But having an older brother who was very cool and everybody liked him, he liked all the guys, you know, it just helped. And got sent there. And when I came home on a weekend. Usually, you just stayed there. But I came home on a weekend. I was running around this beauty parlor with a friend of mine who was at the military school. And an agent was sitting next to my mom at Montrose, right up here in...
California.
This house, I was living in this house that we're speaking in right now. This is the house I was sent away from. And I'll tell you,
this was your mom and dad's house?
This was my mom's house.
Your mom's house?
My mom's house.
That you live in now?
I went to Mount Low when we were... We moved into this house while I was in Mount Low. But it was a house that I was sent away from, and I will tell you, I just got new carpet in the house. And I always say this to people, that I really appreciate carpeting and my own bathroom. And there is something with this house where I could just stay home all the time. I could stay home all the time. And it has something to do with, I'm sure, being sent away when I was a kid. Because on Sunday, I would come home on a Friday sometimes. And then on Sunday, right around 1 o'clock, I got to start coming up with, like, I'm just not feeling good. I'm sick. I can't go back to Mount Low because I'm just not feeling good, Mom. And, you know, maybe that's when my acting chops started. And, you know, eventually she'd go, you got to go. And we'd leave this house. And maybe when I was at military school, I'd be picturing this house. Like, if I can just stay home. I mean, you know, but there's something right now where I think from going to military school that I could just stay in this house and be very, very happy.
Right.
Which is cool. So I'm running around a beauty parlor in Montrose, and an agent sitting next to my mom, and she said, hey, you know, your kid's got a good look. Would he like to do commercials? Her name was Pat Domigan. And my mom said, well, he goes to military school. He really can't. But they became friends. And when I graduated from high school, 4'11", 95 pounds, Pat said, you want to try being an actor? I said, sure, because I didn't know what I was going to do. I was maybe going to be a jockey. I had no clue. I just wanted to.
Did you ride, or was it that's a size thing?
I was an athlete, and I was small.
You graduated from school and thinking, I'm small, I can probably do it. Let's try being a jockey.
Well, I'm not sure. It never got there, because right away, Pat said, you want to try acting? And I said, yeah. You know, I didn't get accepted to a college. I tried to go to Loyola Marymount, but I guess my C's and D's weren't good enough for him. You know, military school is not a place to go get an education. It's a place to learn to be a good judge of character and survive and appreciate carpeting.
What do you mean a good judge of character?
You have to learn to read people. You have to learn the good guys and the bad guys, and you have to learn to... I mean, when I was 8 years old, I learned how to take care of myself. I learned how to rely on myself, which, you know, would be great for all kids, for all children to learn how to really take care of yourself, and realize that, you know, you've got to read people. You've got to figure situations out to survive. And
because there were a lot of rough guys there.
Yeah. Or? Oh, yeah. It was just it was a free for all. I mean, Mount Low was a place where parents dropped their kids off and just never came back. There was a lot of kids there that just never. And we just had a reunion. And you should see this reunion. It's like a cuckoo's nest reunion. It's like these people are still have unresolved stuff, and they tell stories about Mount Low, and each one is like, wow. I mean, just crazy. The teachers, if you saw the yearbook, the teachers were, you know, all weird. We've tried to write about it. A friend of mine, John Lillibridge, and I have done some treatments about Mount Low, but it's such a big story, and it's such a, you know, it's from the first grade through the eighth grade is what it was, or no, through the 10th grade. It was kindergarten through the 10th grade. And, you know, it was a madhouse. It really was a madhouse. It turned out the colonel was taking money. There was a Japanese guy who was in charge there, Junso. I'm telling you, this guy was the scariest guy. And you're a little kid. This Junso guy who was in an internment camp, angry, had this paddle. Just insane. Just insane. And there were microphones in the room. So if you heard something going on in the barracks at night, you'd sleep on these... Like I say, it was Stalag 17. You slept on, like, if you saw Stalag 17, that was this military school. It was just these thin mattresses, and he would come in and dump the thing. It was like made out of steel, and he'd throw your bed.
And when you were sleeping.
Yeah, and I've, you know what, we're talking about it right now. I don't think about it, and my recall is not really good with it. My recall with a lot of stuff isn't real good, and I'm not even sure why that is.
Well, you were
except for that. I think I'm just protecting myself from it.
Sure,
or something.
You were a little boy.
A little boy, yeah. And it's sometimes when you see a little kid, you kind of go, "Wow, that was young." Or if you tell people, like I'm telling you, you're kind of like, "Wow, that's pretty young." And at the time, you don't think about it, but you know, as you get old and you look back, you go, "Yeah." And I've sent letters home to my mom. And I found these letters one day. It was very interesting. My brother's having a tough time. You know, family is always the number one thing, you know, in all of our lives. Everything else, you know, if you work and whatever you work is all that stuff, you know, it counts, but it really doesn't count. Family counts. And my brother's having a tough time. But I found these letters home, you know, that we were sending from Mount Lowe. And I would always ask my mom, you know, get me out of here. You know, and they'd be very funny letters. They would have a sense of humor, and my friends, we would do these little comedy things. But essentially, it was like this woman, Miss Spence, who was a teacher, is hitting me, and I got to get out of here. And it was letter after letter of get me out of here. And I showed them to my mom, and I said, "Did you read any of these? Did you hear what I was saying?" And she said, "Mark, stop it." You know, it was too hard for her to even hear the letters. And she goes, "Look, she was single, and she just couldn't do it."
Right.
So anyway, and I found some letters from my brother. My brother, I wasn't connected to the divorce, but my brother took it personal. He blamed himself for the divorce, and my dad, a couple years after we went to military school, killed himself. And Mike took that on where I didn't.
You not take it on?
I just didn't. I wasn't connected to it. And Mike was. Mike was, and he blamed himself for the divorce. He blamed himself. These letters, man, were tough, man. He was crying in these letters, and it was tough, man. I tell you, and I found this box, and I was sitting out in front of my garage, and I keep reading letters, and they kind of, you know, there's all different kind of letters. And then finally one, and as Mike got older, and when I say older, he was probably about 13 or 14, sending letters home. And he finally got to a point. The letters kept getting shorter and shorter. Finally, there was one letter. It had a line, just a line. You know, it was.
He made a line for what? What do you think?
It was just. He just wore out, man. He just wore out.
So, yeah. And, you know, I'm sorry about
Mike
that.
Today.
Yeah,
it's you know, it's tough, but it's yeah, it's what it is, man. It's family. It's family, and that's what you kind of connect to.
And here's the interesting thing to me, Mark. I mean, not that it's not. I mean, my dad was raised in an orphanage during the Depression, and he tells those stories and of a different time, a different culture, and he talks about you know, those reunions where men would come and try to go in to this orphanage in Philadelphia, and he said you could watch them, and they would walk up these stairs and literally be unable to like touch the door.
Wow.
You know, and they just couldn't. Yeah. And this is a grown man, and this is a guy who went to school, and they went to college, and they did everything. A captain of industry in a suit who's going back to see this place, and just the wave hits him, and they just can't touch the knob.
I can relate to that.
Yeah.
Junzo Ogawa, who was working at New Mexico Military Academy, this must have been in the beginning of the 80s or something. I'm up there for a dog sled race in Tahoe, New Mexico. And I was training for a week for this dog sled race. And it's the day of the race. All of a sudden I hear this, "Hey, McClure." And I turn around. It's Junzo Ogawa walking up. And he's still got a uniform on from the New Mexico Military Academy.
Paddle?
No paddle. But my body literally shut down.
Yeah, yeah.
It was this. I had been training for a week up in this altitude. And I was ready. And when I saw him, my body just went. It was so bizarre. But that's the going up the steps and touching the door. That in your childhood, and you know, we only kind of get those little wake ups now and then, I guess. I don't know, unless you completely, you know, dedicate your life to trying to figure out why your parents sent you somewhere, why somebody was so mean to you, and you know, all those kind of things. But Jun, and without even knowing, but Jun Sugawa just absolutely shut my body down. It was very interesting. And usually I, you know, I'm a very nice person, very considerate person to everybody. And I had to excuse myself from him. He was talking, kind of talking. And I literally just said, look, I've got to go. And I just never do that. But at least I had the strength in that moment to say, look, I can't even stand here with you. It was interesting. And it's, you know.
Well, it's a testament to you. I mean, so many people do it, but at least you know that even early on, even when you were 8 years old, yeah. Mark came to Mark's defense.
Yeah.
Like you're talking about taking care of yourself, but yeah. You went like, I'm going to handle this, and this is the way I'm going to handle it, and probably it's going to go to a deep place in my life, but I'm going to take care of Mark.
Yeah, and I think maybe acting, you know, the fact that I became an actor, everything in my life I feel is very, you know, very guided. I feel very like I have a guardian angel. Everything's very blessed. And I think with the acting, like, you know, somehow growing up the way I did, learning characters and learning how people are, just kind of helped me out in a way. I mean, I haven't been playing a lot of deep characters, but I've just been able to pretend to be somebody else. And it seems to have come easy. You know, when you get the opportunity to do it, mm-hmm. It seems to come easy. And you seem to, when they say roll camera, somehow it happens. And I try to stay in a very real place when I'm acting. And it just, it may have something to do with my upbringing. Because yeah, I never sure. took acting lessons.
You just started. You were just small.
And I know you are a very trained actor. You really worked hard at the craft. And when you came to Hollywood, you were ready to take it on and you know, use all of this training. And really, when you come to Hollywood, a lot of the training is out the window.
It is absolutely out the window. And you discover that very quickly. And I don't mean... And when I meet an actor like you, it was so impressive to me. I was such a young guy that it just, like... For you, it was just falling off a log.
Yeah.
It was just, you do it. You just pretend. Yeah. It's like a fake thing. You just like, I was a guy from the East Coast,
yeah.
from a certain level of intensity,
stage.
Of study, of the stage. You yeah. must study this, and you yeah. must do this, step one, step two, step three. These are the preparations that you make. This is the kind of thing that you do. And I come out, and I'm in this thing with you, yeah. and you were so, it was so impressive. Because you were so, you, it seemed like... You know, I don't mean to minimize, but you were that California guy that yeah. just, yeah, whatever, we're good.
Yeah.
Well, you just know, roll it again, whatever.
Wendy and I, who had been together through all of these little things together, it was our third film, I believe, with Bob Z.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of a comfort maybe there.
Right.
I don't know, maybe. Right. But also, you know, with Crispin, I mean, when you talk about, I'm not even sure if he was almost beyond method, because he would continue to do that same thing. I mean, I remember that dinner table scene. He would just literally do the same thing every time, and it was just like...
It was very prepared in order to get, if I do X, Y, and Z, the reaction is going to be... whatever it is.
He's saying, I'm going down this same road. This,
yeah.
Every time he yells action, I am going to go down this road the same way. I am going to turn to my left right when I say this, and I'm going to turn to my right when I say this. And it was an interesting thing. I don't know if he always did that with his work.
I don't know.
But in this particular one, he was very locked into... You know, an idea.
Well, I would certainly do it different ways, you know, and experiment yeah. while right. we're shooting. But you, it was like you were riding a cloud.
Yeah.
It was like you were just coming in like wee.
Yeah.
We're just playing, you know. Well, and it was so so inspiring to me. But let's go back to the 4:11 guy. I mean, you come out and you start doing commercials.
I start doing commercials. And I start playing, I think my very first job, I did a Walt Disney film. But I think the first job was with Charles Durning, a little television show called Cop and the Kid. And I played an obnoxious 12-year-old.
Yeah. So and that's what you could do when you were
that's
little.
That's what I could do. And what happens is when you're 18, they don't have to send you to school. They don't have to, you don't have to do all of this, you know, this stuff. They could use you and work you all day long. Where if you were really a 12-year-old, I think maybe they could work you 5 hours. I forget what it was.
Right. They have to have, like, social workers there, and you have to go to school and all that stuff. Yeah. So if you were 18 and looked like you could play 12, physically small and everything, man, you're made in the shade.
Yeah. It happens. Okay.
So
I just started, and I started, and I did the Freaky Friday, and I think in Freaky Friday with Jodie Foster.
The first Freaky Friday, was that
played,
it?
Yeah, the
like
very
the,
first Freaky
the
Friday.
The Freaky Friday?
Yeah. With Barbara Harris, and Barbara Harris was gorgeous. She was so cute. And actually, Jodie Foster's sister, who was her stand-in, was a real cutie. Because here I was at military school. I hadn't had a lot of experience with the ladies. And, you know, they would always kind of make me nervous because I really didn't know. I just didn't know enough about them, you know.
Sure.
And she was a cutie. Barbara Harris was totally cute. God, was she gorgeous. She was from New York. And Gary Nelson was the director. He was a very hip guy. And it just was a great job. And I think I was playing 14 or 15. I think Jodie was maybe that could have been her actual age at the time. And she was very cute. And then in the year 1977, I've been doing some films, been doing television, things been going good. I'm living on a houseboat in Marina Del Rey.
You see, that's the California guy that I
And I'll tell you one thing, living on the house was pretty cash. I mean, it was a 50-foot houseboat. You could untie the ropes, push away. I had two diesel engines on it. And the reversers would always break. So you'd have to just have somebody with you just jump off and hold the boat. But it was so fun living down there. And what happened was I get a call saying they're casting for Superman. And so I go to the office. It's Lynn Stallmaster's office, and Dick Donner's in there, and Tom Mankiewicz, who wrote it, and Dick Donner, who is the director. And I go in, and he says, "Hey, so what are you doing?" And even whenever I went to interviews, I just talked. You know, it wasn't like I was pitching anything, or I was just going along for the ride. Like I say, this agent gave me the opportunity. I didn't know really anything about what I was stepping into, mm-hmm. So I just kind of started and just kind of kept my personality going.
Yeah.
So I go in there, and he says, "So what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm living on a houseboat." And Dick Donner always wanted to live on a boat. So we talked about boats for the whole interview, maybe 15, 20 minutes, just talking about boats. Finally, he says, "Great, thanks for coming in." And on my way out, he said, "By the way, do you know who Jimmy Olsen is?" And I turn around, I said, "Golly, Mr. Kent." You know, because I knew who Jimmy Olsen was. And they laughed, and I left. And it was kind of done.
Really?
Yeah, and it was like, when I say done, I didn't hear from him. I think it was, you know, maybe for 3 months. And I was hearing about Brando's being cast, and I'm hearing all these stories. And, you know, it was just one that I didn't get, whatever. And all of a sudden, I got a call back about 3 months later. I walked in, Dick Donner, and I'm sitting out there with this other actor. His first name was Chris, and I forget his last name right now, but he had been doing things. And I saw him in the air. I said, "Hey, you're here for Jimmy Olsen?" He goes, "No, I'm here for," I think he said, "Peter Pan." Or, you know,
I was like, "Oh, just blowing you off or something?"
Just blew me off.
"I'm auditioning for Peter Pan. Get lost."
And I'm sitting. Now we're sitting in the lobby, and now I'm uncomfortable. You know, I'm trying to have a conversation with this guy and just talk. And all of a sudden, he kind of gave this cold cloud thing. And so all of a sudden, I'm just sitting there and it's uncomfortable. But I go in. Dick Donner just said, "I want to remember what you look like. You got the job." Never read.
So you had a meeting with him where you talked houseboats.
Talked houseboats.
The next meeting, he goes, "Well, you got it.
You got it." No reading. Never had to read. Never had to read. Never had to really do anything. And a week later, I left California for London, and I was in London for 6 months.
So you were just like from a week before doing commercials, doing whatever it is. Yeah. And it's new. Some...
And all of a sudden I'm in London doing the Superman movies. And, you know, looking back, I don't know if I really appreciated my moments. I don't think I really ever appreciated, you know, the luck I was having. I didn't really appreciate. I was just going. I was just going. And looking back, I mean, it was a big deal at the time. And I didn't think of it as a big deal.
You really didn't?
I really didn't.
You were really Jimmy Olsen. Didn't know. I know what.
It was just.
Noelle Neal, she was in the movie, right?
She was in the movie. Margot Kidder was there.
Yeah.
And Chris.
Who played Jimmy Olsen in the original, in the TV show?
Jack Larson.
I see him
every so often, and he looks the same. He's a great guy. I talked to him afterwards.
Yeah.
But I knew who Jimmy Olsen was.
Sure.
I knew his energy. But and it's almost like all the jobs, like you were saying, with Back to the Future. I was just having fun. There was nothing to lose, I guess. There was nothing, because I didn't really win it. You know, I didn't work to get into that spot. Uh-huh. I just kind of found myself in the spot, and it was all just kind of...
So you didn't do any of that insecure actor, Mr. Donner, how was that? Was that scene? You were just like, that's it, that's what it is,
I was just going. And like in Superman, like there's a scene, and Dick Donner, he is the greatest. I've been so lucky with the directors, Ron Howard, Bob Zemeckis, Dick Donner. I mean, did I say Ron Howard? Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's nice to mention him twice.
Just in case he's still working a lot. Yeah.
Oh my God. He is really the great, and he was the reason why that film, one and two, the Donner cut, was what it was, and just a fabulous guy. And when you went there, you got to rehearse the scenes. When we were on the set, you know, with Margot, she was brilliant. Chris is really, really serious on the set. I mean, away from the set, he was a goofball. But on the set, he was a method actor. I mean, I guess somewhat of a method actor, but he was really trained, Juilliard trained.
Right.
Juilliard trained. So when he's there, he wants you to refer to him as... Superman.
Really?
Well, there's a scene, I'll get back to that, but there was a scene when we were on wires above the stage, and I'm kind of rambling on like I do.
You're just
like
goofing just, off? You're just talking, about talking life. And, but you happen to be flying.
I happen to be up on the rigs with him, mm-hmm. on the wires.
Yeah, and he's carrying you.
He's in his outfit. Yeah. Yeah, he's carrying me over the dam. I think it was the dam scene. And I'm rambling on because I got no pressure on me. You know, I don't even know. I'm not even thinking about anything except for this is just fun, and here we are. And he finally stopped me. He said, look, if you can talk like Jimmy Olsen, that would help me. And that was very early on, and it was a total gift because right then I got it. I got, first of all, him, of the responsibilities that he had at that moment in his life playing Superman. And for him, you know, he was taking it seriously, and he should have. And it was a big deal. And I realized, like, yeah, I've got it on the set. I got to respect this guy for what he's got to accomplish doing this. And that was a real helpful thing, maybe, you know, for me the rest of my life as far as acting. That for other actors, you just have to respect them. You know, I mean, there's sometimes in a scene you have to recognize, you know, when a person needs that.
Giving them what they need.
Yeah, and when you're on the set, you know, just kind of, like I said, to be a good judge of character, you have to kind of come on a set and just say, okay, how is he working? Is he going to need me or does he need me? And he kind of gave me that at that time. And from then on, I just worked with him. I worked with him and I tried to help him and play Jimmy, and that kind of helped me. And it was all cool. But and back to the Donner, you got to find things when you rehearsed. And it wasn't set in stone, the script or anything. And we would find things when we rehearsed, things that were funny, things that were very natural, very, you know, very real. And there was a scene with Jackie Cooper in the office in Superman 1 where the line was, "Don't call me Chief." And we did my close-up first. And off camera, instead of saying, "Don't call me Chief," he actually said, "Don't call me Sugar." Because the line before that is, "Get me coffee with no sugar," and then he said, "Don't call me Sugar," and I reacted to his "Don't call me Sugar" to write Sugar, and that was that's what made the film. So when they turned around and got Jackie's close up, and Dick Donner just said, "Hey, say Sugar, just in case,
right? In case we use it,
mm-hmm. you know, this all plays together." And he did, and Donner kind of had that ability. Bob Zemeckis has that ability. Ron Howard has that ability where he lets the actors find these very real... All their movies, for as bizarre as they are in some cases, these are all very real people that you can relate to. And I love that. That's the kind of stuff I love,
mm-hmm.
when it's kind of real. And I'm never really over the top. I'm never kind of... If anything, I'm just under. I'm just trying to be believable. When I'm done with a scene, I just hope I was believable. Whatever, you know, the situation has to be the situation. But you just have to be believable in that situation. And I always, that's what I always try to do. And Dick Donner was, you know, really brilliant in that. And like I say, all these directors that I've been lucky enough to work with, they've all got that. You know, and if they all had that, we'd have a lot of great films. But unfortunately, there's just not that many great films.
So it's a matter of, I think, what, relaxing into the character as opposed to working on it and getting and building your kind of superstructure of whatever you're building around the character to hang your little kites or whatever you have for your business. Yeah, you're just going, hey, man, just do it. Just
because there's one of those, the situation is, and the trick to, I would tell any actor, is listening. And let's just say you have all this built-up stuff. You have all this pre-scheduled stuff. And you're listening to somebody. And all of a sudden they're saying it differently. Or they're saying, or they're getting their words wrong and they're saying something else. You have to be ready for that. There's no way, and there's no way you can prepare for that. So to go in, you know, being prepared with your lines, but being prepared to listen, then you're safe. Because as long as you're listening, your face is listening. And you are listening. And that is, I think, the key to acting, is listening. Because then you're reacting to what they're saying. And if it's not in the script and they're saying something, it's like the improv kind of stuff, you're reacting to it. You know, because you're hearing it. And
right. You're hearing it. You're living in it. And you're just ready. If they say something that's off, you're just saying something back.
Yeah. And if I like had some preconceived thing, like when this guy's going to say, hey, you better jump in the water, you know, and I was thinking, like, my reaction would be, well, I'm not, I don't know, whatever the reaction would be. You can't prepare, you can't prearrange that. You can't prearrange something that somebody's going to tell you. You can only kind of prearrange it when you maybe do a rehearsal. And if the person kind of gives you something, then the director says, oh, that there it is. Then you all of a sudden, now you kind of know where it's all going. I guess at that point, you can start to anticipate it, even though you don't want to anticipate it.
And then, as you know, you can get into a scene with the really relaxed, living in it guy.
Yeah.
And Mr. Super Preparation.
Oh, yeah.
All the lines have to be, look, you have to, at that point in the scene, you have to say, let's all jump in the water.
Yeah.
Because I don't, if something else happens, I don't know what to do. I have nothing.
You have to be.
I will be standing there going,
As soon as you're done talking, I'm going to say jump in the water.
Right.
Hurry.
Yeah,
it's so true. You know, and Michael J. Fox, here's two guys that I've worked with that have both been dealing with something in their life, that have both gone to the podium and talked about it, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, I think in my lifetime to have two guys that I respect to have.
Well, that's true, isn't it? I mean, to both guys of both
same
these
kind of
big
thing.
Movies. I mean, you worked a million things,
yeah.
But I wanted to ask you about that because being connected in the popular culture to a gigantic iconic figure like Superman. I mean, and then this terrible accident happens to Chris Reeve. God bless him, and he loses his life. But you are inexorably attached to that in some way in the people's mind. Do you find that? Because, you know, people have that, oh, you played Superman. Yeah. Hey, how did you react to the thing?
You know, everybody's, oh, you know, and it's a big deal for people. And, you know, when they like the movie. And a lot of the questions, yeah, sad to hear about Chris. And I'm like, well, you know what? He took it on. It really wasn't sad. It was kind of an evolution of a sort, I guess, of that the spinal cord, you know, spine cell research, spinal cord research and stem cell research and all of that. Chris took that on, was a spokesman for it, and kind of did, I mean, here, yeah, the weird thing is he was Superman, and then he's a guy in a wheelchair that could only pretty much speak. And then he can only speak, you know, gasping, getting air from this ventilator. And you couldn't go to two extremes. You couldn't
from
get
being
that.
Yeah,
you
could, Superman. You could, yeah, I mean, in people's imaginations.
Yeah, but in a lifetime, let's just call it in our lifetime, to know somebody that has those two extremes and to deal with it in the way they dealt with it, you know, because you don't know. Everybody's going to do it differently. He could have very easily just slinked away and, you know, and just done nothing. But he really took it on, and I don't know. You know, I think in my lifetime, yeah, I mean, I'm just feel real grateful to have known the guy.
Sure.
And to know his strength. And same thing with Mike is what he's doing with what he's dealing with Parkinson's and how he's taken it on. And it's just like it is amazing when you think about it. I don't think about it too much, but it has been in my lifetime. You know, that's another thing too, is like, you know, with our lives, we don't pat ourselves on the back all the time. We don't do anything for ourselves. We do things. I mean, my character, I do things for other people, and that's just who I am. And maybe to a fault, I don't know. But you don't really think about your accomplishments as we get older. I guess we do. And, you know, every so often you'll see a book, you'll see something that'll kind of trigger something, but it's, you don't really realize how far you've come. You know, really, I'm 55 years old, and that's a lot of years, man. That's a lot of days. And I'm still alive. I mean, that's amazing in itself.
Yeah.
And let alone all the stuff that we've kind of fit in there, the amazing stuff, the amazing crisscross of roads of meeting Donner and living on a houseboat and talking about boats. I don't know if that was the thing that got me over, but you know, and then meeting Bob Zemeckis. I remember for the very first film that he did for I Want to Hold Your Hand. And
which you were great. Yeah, I mean, just a fabulous, fun movie.
His casting session, I think he spent months casting that. Like, you would have to keep coming back and read, and then he would be pairing you up, and you'd have different people. It was an amazing, and every time you went back, because you were still not hired, you were thinking, one of these, and that's always think whenever I have to read a lot or I have to keep going back and read the same thing, I think I'm going to blow it.
Of course you are.
My first time through is always great. It's just great. It's just because it's just natural. I haven't put any thought into it. All of a sudden you get a call back. Oh, they want you to come back and read again for these people. And you go, okay, so I start to study it. And then all of a sudden now you're kind of maybe putting a little bit more study into it. And there's more thought to it. So all of a sudden, it's not quite the original. And I always think, just you taped it, you videotaped it. Can't you just play that and let them all go, he's fantastic. Right. Why do I got to go in the room again with, you know, sometimes, did you ever do?
Oh, my gosh, a million times.
With the executives like at CBS?
Of course.
How uncomfortable.
Of course. And you see, you do. So can't you two guys that were there that first time just share the magic with everyone and tell everybody how wonderful it was?
Especially you guys that aren't even breathing when I'm reading.
Yeah, because I'm probably going to blow it, because now I'm overthinking it. I've been back four times now.
Yeah, yeah.
I've overthought the whole thing just way too much.
Like, in my mind, I was good to go on the first two.
Yeah.
But now that you have me back there, I have my own doubts.
On the fifth one,
man. I don't even think I'm that good. I think you should just give it to somebody else, because I've talked myself out of it.
The fifth callback, and you're... one of them, you're going to choke on one of them. It's
going to be different, and they're going to go, well, look at that. It was different that time.
and he wore a different shirt.
Yeah,
and I liked him in the blue shirt.
Yeah, I liked him in the blue shirt. He wore that plaid thing. Let's just not do it. But in television, you do get a lot of takes. And in film, you get a lot of takes. In on stage, there's no double takes.
This whole thing
really is not a big deal. There's not too much excitement to it because, you know, we aren't curing cancer. We aren't getting a whole lot done except for just getting on celluloid, which is forever. And if you're lucky enough to be in a good film, that is very cool. But, you know, to get excited about these auditions and these guys sitting around, because everybody that's watching you, their job is in jeopardy. Everybody in that room is so scared. You know,
it's just, you could feel the fear.
Nobody wants to say I like him.
Fog in the air, just thick.
Yeah, you wait for Tartikoff to say, you know what, I like him too. No one's going to say that first.
Right.
No one says that first.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing. And I don't know. I always say just hire your brother because he could do it. You know, hire a family member.
Hire a family member. Just give him enough takes.
Yeah.
One of them's going to be okay.
And I say that with commercials. I do the commercials. I say just let your sister do it because, you know, she'll get residuals. It's a great gig.
Yeah.
Just get her one of these. That
all she has to do is say, pizza rolls? Yep. Hey. That's it.
Yeah, let her do it. And she'd be fantastic. Believe me, nobody's going to go, that was a wrong choice. Yeah. You know, when it's on the television, we just accept whoever it is.
Yeah.
And if they're bizarre, even if it's like real bad casting, that works better.
Right.
It works better if it's bad casting. Yeah.
Can I ask you one Superman question before I leave you alone about
it?
Here we go. No. But I just, when you were first on the set.
Yeah.
And there's Christopher Reeve, very handsome guy with the black hair.
Oh my God, did he
look
real?
And he's wearing the outfit. I mean, did it just blow you away? I mean, because you're a kid. Let me tell you my boring Superman story with Dean Cain, and then you tell me. Yeah. But I was on. I did the super. I never met Chris Reeve or was on the movies.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did that TV show that Dean Cain was in, Lois and Clark or whatever. And I'm in it. I'm doing a scene with John Spencer, wonderful actor, great guy. He's passed away, but he's been a lot of TV shows that people recognize. So John and I are in this scene, and Dean Cain comes out of the trailer there. Wearing the most beautiful costume you could imagine. The Superman costume with the red cape
and the embroidered S on his chest with the
black hair swept back.
Yeah.
And he walks up to it. And Dean's a great guy, really funny and everything, real relaxed. But he walks up to us, and John Spencer, who's older than me, at the time, you know, John is somewhere in his 50s. And Dean goes, you know, how you guys doing? And John Spencer goes, you got to excuse me. You're Superman. I was about to say the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Superman just walks up to you.
And goes, how you doing?
How's it going, guys? Yeah. You're Superman.
Chris never said that.
No.
Chris never said how you doing in the Superman outfit.
No, oh, was he very Superman-ish?
He would never really see. I mean, kids really never got to be around. When he was in the Superman outfit, he did not want to be around kids. He did not. And if it, he just wouldn't do it. He just didn't. I don't know. For whatever reason, he just wasn't into that. He just, you know, when he was in the outfit, he was in the outfit to work.
He was an actor in the role.
And I'm telling you,
work.
Yeah. And was Dean, how tall was Dean?
Dean was a tall guy. I don't know, 6'2", something like
okay,
that. Yeah.
Okay, okay, okay. And, so, and he filled it out with natural.
Oh, yeah, very strong.
Because Chris was pretty skinny when he got the job, but he, you know, like at lunch, he would be eating two plates of food. I mean, he really bulked up. And he did look like the guy. First of all, he was an unknown face.
Right.
He looked like the guy. He looked like the guy. And, yeah, when he was in the outfit, it goes back to, you know, where Chris, you know, and we were on the wires. You know, as colorful as can be, when he was in that Superman outfit, it couldn't get more serious. It just really couldn't. And it couldn't become more important for him to play that role. Being a stage actor, you put on that Superman outfit, I imagine that's got to be kind of ultimate. It's the responsibility. I mean, that was it's such an old character. The responsibility with putting that thing on must be through the roof. And I don't know, and I think he was aware of that. I don't know if Dean was as aware of it. I don't know. The other people, like I saw the new one, the new movie. The new movie with the, I forget his name.
They made a new.
The new movie, Superman Returns. Superman Returns with the, I couldn't even tell you.
This is how connected I am to the culture, but that's out?
I know. It was out and it was kind of gone. And nobody ever told me to go see it. It was the one right after us, and it was called Superman Returns. And nobody really ever told me to see it. Everybody's kind of, well, it's not. And I finally saw it. And it really just wasn't. It just, you know, and maybe I'm prejudiced. You know, whoever follows Chris, good luck to him.
Yeah.
I mean, really. Good luck.
Well, we know the new Jimmy Olsen was terrible.
Please, please. No, actually, he was a very nice guy, Mr. Sam Huntington. And he was a nice guy, but the director didn't treat the characters like the characters. Everything was kind of lost, and it just something was wrong. Something was wrong.
The fear of that middle committee, huh? Just kind of can take over these things.
Yeah.
Can it?
Yeah.
I mean, the fear that you were talking about in that office.
Oh, yeah.
And where there was two guys, and then there's six, and then there's 12.
Yeah.
And then once there's a half you know, two dozen, you're dead.
It's too many people.
Somebody's going to say, hey, maybe we could change the cape.
Yeah.
Maybe the cape could be like a solid, like a bulletproof thing. Oh. Look, he's Superman. I'm just saying, Batman did well. He could have a bulletproof. He is bulletproof.
Well, you know what? I'll say to the, in the Donner Cut, Superman 2, the Donner Cut, they left in the a screen test for Margot Kidder and Christopher Reeve working together in a screen test. It's in the movie. And they show screen tests of different actresses. And with casting, you really do know when the right person is on film and starts talking. I think there's just something with films and acting and casting that that's the person. And Margot was the person. Chris was the guy. I think once Donner saw Chris, and he had to fight for him because they wanted Sylvester Stallone. They wanted Robert Redford. I mean, it was crazy.
They wanted Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they wanted a name. Yeah, they wanted a name. What happened? Then they got Brando. All of a sudden, they didn't need a name. You know, all of a sudden, it wasn't, you know, now we can maybe, you know, get somebody else. And Donner was really fighting for Christopher Reeve. And you know, it was brilliant because, you know, to have an unknown, to introduce. And I think I love that. I love going into a movie theater and just being introduced to somebody new, you know, because you just accept them. These days, you know, here comes George Clooney. It's like, oh, yeah, I've just read in the Inquirer. He's a, yeah, shh. You know, it's just kind of, there's just, you got to suspend belief a little bit more these days with the actors because they're involved in, you know, he was just in a commercial for Prail Concentrate or something. You know, there's just more, you're just more exposed to these people except for just in the movies. Where back in the day, you would just see Hollywood movie actors. You wouldn't see him in a commercial. You wouldn't see him on television. So these days, when you go into a movie theater, you know, it's hard to really get that escapism. Really. There's certain films that pull it off, but it's hard. It really is.
Mark, I'm going to take a break right now because this is a two-parter.
Is it two-parter?
It's a two-parter. Okay. Because, I mean, I start talking to you. I just, it's fascinating.
Yeah, no,
and thank you so much for being
emotional.
With me.
I got emotional with my little brother's story, but
I think it was a very
thing. It's very true. And you know, like I was saying, family is tough. And his family is the only thing we got. But I am. I think I'm getting more emotional as I get older. I think I've always had it. And maybe it's something that has been suppressed because of how I grew up, you know.
But this is very nice.
I really love doing this.
Would it be all right
if I just stop
and say goodbye to the people and then do another one?
Absolute.
All right. Thank you, Mark McClure, man. You're unbelievable.
Thank you, Thomas Wilson.
As you could hear by our conversation, Mark McClure is a very special guy, a very sensitive artist, and one of my favorite people. I'm so glad that he agreed to have me talk to him and record it for you guys. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to everybody at Nerdist Industries. Thank you to McPherson Guitars, to Dean Markley String, which is what I use, and thanks especially to you. Thank you so much for listening. Please consider subscribing or consider coming out to see me in a live show. I'm all over the place, people, and we're having a good time out there. So thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.